a preface. There are three principles I hold that I may accidentally violate today. The first is that it wasn't until his death that I realized that Ronald Reagan did anything of good, because my parents could never say anything good about him. So I have taken a vow, or at least pushed Karen to assume this process, that we won't speak about politics in front of our kids, that they should make their own decisions. Another principle that I hold dear is that a rabbi is no expert on politics and should not speak from a place of partisanship, but at best could speak from Jewish tradition's evaluation of political policy. And the third principle is that one should preach from one's scars and not one's wounds, which is to say, this election is extremely fresh for all of us, and I haven't yet processed it. And that will take months and years. Nonetheless, there were rabbis who had to preach on, I think, Rosh Hashanah about 9/11. That, as one of my colleagues put it, it was like Iron Chef for sermons. You had to assemble a sermon in just a few days because everyone needed to hear about 9/11. Everyone needed spiritual wisdom. So I'm going to endeavor to tread lightly on those three principles, that it is not my job to tell you how to vote, inasmuch as I don't want my children to learn from me how to vote, although it is important that they vote. I do not know politics any better than you. I'm well-read, but I think many of you already are. And I'm not yet done understanding the ramifications, personal and global, of this election. And we won't know those answers for a long time. One of the most beautiful points and salient points that was raised in this morning's discussion in the library was by Marcus, who said that the great feeling we all have and all share on all sides of the aisle is uncertainty. Many of us didn't sleep this week. For some, it was because of adrenaline and excitement, and for others, it was grief and fear. And those are all understandable. As our mayor would say, good people can disagree on policies. And we can't assume that people on the other side of a political argument than ourselves are wicked or naive. We all, most of us, there are a few viewpoints that I would consider beyond the pale, but most opinions are just ways of getting to some outcome of the good, and we can disagree on details. We should. That is, as we know in the synagogue board, for example, how you arrive at good conclusions, by disagreeing on the details. That's how Israel, as I'm reading in one of our books for our book club, arrives at entrepreneurship. So excuse me if at any point in this talk you learn about my political opinions. That's not my goal. And if it's too obvious, you can tell me, because I try to keep that close to the chest. This week's parasha, Parashat Lech Lecha, when Abraham is introduced, it's like a cliffhanger. There's a person who's introduced in Noach. You've seen Abraham for the first time, and who will this person be? Has some ugliness in it, some strangeness, has some shouting and screaming. There is one of the first places that Abraham encounters God is at this two-lettered place called Ai, which I think is like the word of screaming. You know, it's an onomatopoetic word to indicate that there was shock, as one had stepped on something electrical. That Abraham's first experience was of God was an outpouring, an ejaculation of surprise. It's not a pretty word either. Likewise, not long after, there is what is called the covenant of the parts, where Abraham has this vision, this dream, and as a result takes many animals, cuts them in half, lays them on each side of a path, and walks through them, which we know from previous studies of the history was a way of indicating through covenant that should I break the terms of our relationship together, may I be split asunder as these animals are. But it's an ugly ritual. It's a terrifying moment in Abraham's experience. And there is another ugly point that I wouldn't euphemize, I don't think that's a word, but I'm going to use it, or whitewash, which we just read, and where's Rafe? Rafe correctly said, Abraham pimps Sarai. There's no nice way to describe what Abraham does. He's afraid, he tells his wife to pose herself as a relation, and uses her. It's not clear that the sexual pimping is consummated, but it is clearly intended. Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't realize we had children here, so I should have used, okay. There has been a lot of ugliness in our communities, in our world, and in this nation. Paroxysms of violence and grief and resentment and fear, some abetted by our political leaders, some endogenous to people, and a result of decades of venom and otherization, of making people who disagree with us into something we don't understand, nor do we even try to understand. There is a question of whether hate crimes have increased since the election. It doesn't seem clear that they have, but it may be true. And there has been violence at rallies, and there has been a lot of hateful speech on all sides. It's an ugly moment. As a Chinese curse goes, may you live in interesting times. Well, that seems to be where we live. And it's been brewing for a while. In my lifetime, I would say 20 years. And we're reaching an apogee of that moment, and it's frightening. And it, frankly, we may not be at the climax. There was a wonderful discussion this morning about optimism versus pessimism. I don't know. I don't know what the right answer is. As Marcus pointed out, most of all, we just don't know what the future holds. And I saw in a lot of people, in a lot of groups, not voting for, but voting against, disenfranchisement with the system is sort of giving up, sort of throwing one's hand in the air. And we're told at the very opening of the parasha that God says to Abraham, to Avram, go forth, proceed. As I said to the preschool class yesterday, when I visit them for Shabbat, I said that travel makes us wiser, that exploring and learning of other people and new places is a great thing. Wherever you go, there you are, but nonetheless, the experience of voyage is a powerful one. And there's even studies now that indicate that one of the ways to escape poverty is simply to change zip codes. That may be the truth. But what we saw, frankly, in the election was voting and activism based on resentments and fear. And one of our recent sages, Yecheskel of Kozmir, I believe is in eastern Poland, said, when you are fleeing, there is no whither. You don't have a destination. Flight often has no goal nor basis, and the refugee doesn't think quite often of where he or she is going. Which is a great metaphor for where we find ourselves. We are moving from, but it's not clear where we are moving to. And one of the hopes at this moment is that decisions, both by the electorate and by our elected officials, will be made with the best motives in mind, not with disappointment or grief or resentment or fear as the prime motivator, but with courage and optimism and shared purpose, hoping against hope. Lot has this opportunity, Abraham's uncle, has this opportunity to choose his living space. And he hears, it's a very funny story, he hears, and one knows that Sodom and Gomorrah are not nice places, but he recognizes them as good places to get rich. He chooses Sodom and Gomorrah for the worst possible reasons, and it will play itself out in next week's parasha. So I hope that in this climate, that people are making decisions with the best of intentions. And language of deplorables, language of criminality, that's not productive. And I hope, I believe, in discussion with a colleague and perhaps through my own research, that the vast majority of people are good. And the vast, as we said in previous experiences, Jewish and otherwise, all it takes for evil to flourish is for good men and women to do little, to do nothing, to be silent. I'll get there in a second. But in this week's parasha, we have one of, in Midrash for this week's parasha, in the rabbinic imagining and sermons and homilies on this week's Torah reading, we have one of my favorite lines, that the mitzvot, the precepts, our commandments, were given to us only that we might be refined by them. You who are all here, I imagine at some level you have the kernel, the germ of that truth, that Judaism somehow makes you better, that has the potential to make you a better person. That if you play this game right, this follow these rules, I have rabbis in LA who told me they're writing a 10-step program for Judaism instead of a 12-step program. It's going to be a 10-step spiritual education for Judaism. I haven't seen it yet. But that's the principle, that Judaism makes you refined, that Judaism has the potential to create an environment that allows ethics and virtue to flourish. That would be the way Greeks understood ethics, that the point of a civic culture is to create a system whereby virtue flourishes. And I'm never so naive or Pollyanna to say that Judaism makes you a good person. I think it creates a threshold and an opportunity to become a good person. But religion has many aspects and is manifold and has opportunities to be wicked and commit genocide, just as it does opportunities to make you wise and kind. So what do we do with all that? We live in an era where people are good, I believe, but certainly people have stopped talking to each other. Certainly people experience their whole lives without reading a newspaper that disagrees with their pre-existing opinions. There is a concept in sociopolitics, I forget the first name, but it's called the blank window. It's named for a social scientist. And it says that the window is the things that are allowed in public discourse. You know, we no longer in America talk about communism or racial segregation. Those are outside the window. Although it seems that the window is changing. And that can be a source of concern, should be a source of concern. But that is to say also that everything within that window is fair game, is a part of public discourse, and we've stopped talking to people, even within the window, that disagree with us. You can spend your whole life reading the Huffington Post and never reading the Free Beacon, which is actually a pretty good conservative newspaper or online source. You can spend your whole life listening to Hannity and never listen to Rachel Maddow. That's a problem. That's not okay. And one of the conservative complaints about academic and institutions of higher learning is that they've stopped being places of discourse. And that's actually a pretty fair criticism. The university was a place, or ideally ought to be a place, where one hears a lot of things one doesn't agree with and is forced to struggle with that. One ought not hear things that are reprehensible, but that window, no matter how you define it, still should be pretty wide. And it's constricted for many of us. So this parasha contains one of my favorite moments in Midrash. So at one point, Sarah gives one of her handmaids to Abraham through which to procreate. And they conceive. And Sarah doesn't like that very much. It doesn't work out the way she might have intended. And her speech is, Hamasi alecha, this violence is upon you. Which is an awkward thing. You know, she agreed to it. Why does she change her mind? Why, when the handmaid seems to treat her with high-handedness, does she suddenly resent something she signed up for? So Rabbi Barachia in Midrash explains it in the most beautiful way I know. He translates this. There's struggle to translate it as part of the problem. What does Hamasi Alecha mean? So Rabbi Barachia explains in Rabbi Abba's name, it means, I have a grievance against you. And this is the story they tell. There were two men incarcerated in prison, and the king, for whatever reason, was making his rounds in the dungeon. And one says, execute justice for me. Exonerate me, and they pardon me. And the king looks at that man and says, okay, I'm in a good mood. He pardons him. And then the other fellow says, uses this phrase, Chamasi Alecha, I have a grievance against you. For had you said, execute judgment for us, surely he would have released us both. But you only said, execute judgment for me. So you were pardoned, but not I. So Abraham had said, I go childless. He did not say, we go childless. So in response to his plea to God of saying, I go childless, he was awarded a child. But Sarai, later Sarah, was not. And so she says, I have a grievance against you. Had you included me in your prayer, we would both have had a child, as they will. We don't live alone. We are not unitary. We cannot only understand the American experiment is an experiment for us as Jews, as white persons, as wealthy men, as Republicans, as Democrats. This is an experiment for all. And if you can't spend a little time trying to understand the other side, trying to experience or understand the experience of a Latino, of a lower class worker, of a laborer, of a recent immigrant, of an old family, you're missing out. You're not part of the American experiment if you are just shouting your opinion louder and louder into an echo chamber. That wasn't what our Constitution was designed to do. That wasn't, I don't believe, founding fathers' faults aside, and their condoning of slavery would be high on that list, massacring Indians also, Native Americans also. But as they understand humankind then, their idea was an experiment of government for all people, as they understood who all people were, regrettably. We have to get back to that. We have to get back to a nuanced understanding that this community, this world, this United States is united. It's not just Tennessee versus California. It's not just urban elite versus rural working class and farmers. As Obama said, I believe in 2008, we are all America. There's no red America and blue America. There's just America. And if we can't understand people that are within the appropriate window, again, there's opinions I don't condone. We don't have to try to understand the KKK. I would never go that far. But if we can't understand at least the people who are reading different newspapers to us, this experiment is lost. And I want to conclude with a classic story about this week's parasha, based on a very cute and interesting phrase in Hebrew. So when Abram and Sarai move to, let me make sure I say this correctly, they go to Canaan from Haran. It says that they brought all their movable properties and the souls that they had made. I didn't make souls. I mean, maybe you make a soul when you procreate. But there were no many souls that they made, at least not literally. So our tradition understands that as perhaps the first instance of conversion. Now, I don't believe in exceptionalism for Judaism. I don't believe that we are superior. I don't believe that Judaism is a light unto the nations, as every religious group can be a light unto the nations, but we are not superior or, I'm losing the word. Chosen. No, I believe chosen, everyone can have compacts with God. The word I'm looking for is about triumphalist. Thank you. You helped me get it. I don't believe in being triumphalist about one's religion. But what it says in Sifri, one of our collections of Midrash, is how was this done? What does this really mean to make people, to bring a soul into your covenant with God? Abram would invite people into his home, give them to eat and drink, show them love, and bring them close to God, and thereby they would be converted and brought under the wings of the divine presence. This is to teach us that whoever brings a person under the wings of God's holy presence is considered as though he or she had created that person, formed him, and developed him. In the aftermath of this most fractious, difficult, emotionally fraught election, what do we have left to do? We have to demonstrate goodness. We have to transcend hatred and animosity and be emissaries, not only of Judaism, but of God's good love and of God's chesed, God's grace, and of gemilut chasadim, deeds and acts of loving kindness. And so I'll leave you with a charge. Whatever your reaction to this election, whether you were excited or filled with energy or depressed and grieved, it's up to you to do something. I was on a conference call with rabbis Wednesday, and actually this was the other precept that I wanted to avoid. I had to correct them on this. I was at a synagogue right after an election, and it turned out I voted the same way most of the people in the synagogue did, but the rabbi and a few other people in the synagogue used the word us. I said, we lost this election. And I said, even though I voted for you, please don't use that language. I thought in my head, I was so uncomfortable. I don't want to be included in a group. I want to be known as someone who makes free choices. We're not tribes. Or maybe we are, but in truth, tribes have a lot slimmer boundaries than we think. So the question in this world at this moment, whatever tribe you might think yourself on, whatever you understand yourself to be, Democrat, Republican, Libertarian, Green Party, Communist, Anarchist, whatever, is to demonstrate the value, the goodness of your position, to demonstrate that whatever policy you follow is for the sake of good. You know, there were classic stories of the socialists, Jewish labor socialists, with great ideas and great values that they spoke of, but when you came to their house, their wife was always the one serving tea. You know? That's not okay. That's not what I'm talking about. And so I was reminded on this conference call, I reminded them, don't use us and them language. And they reminded me, as Tip O'Neill would say, all politics is local. Presidential election's an important thing, but there's a lot of politics that exists within a few miles of us, and a lot of politics that exists in our state, and a lot of politics that transcends the boundaries of the United States. And whatever that means to you, whatever you most are drawn to, whether it's working with the Community Coalition Against Human Trafficking or the YWCA or anything that will gain you Glazer hours, do it. Do more of it. You'll help the synagogue through the Glazer Fellowship, but that's not why I'm saying this. But you'll feel empowered, and you'll make your voice heard, because politics isn't just once every 4 years.